Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, U.S. corporate media's Fidel Castro is a cartoon in death no less than in life. While it's implied that our only choice is between hagiography and hatred, there is actual history that provides context for understanding the role of Castro and the Cuban Revolution, which involved more people than him, in history. We'll hear from Luis Perez, history professor at the University of North Carolina and author of, among other titles, Cuba Between Reform and Revolution. Also on the show, while much is uncertain, one thing we do know about the coming days is that those who hope to protect what Donald Trump threatens and resist what he seeks to impose will need to talk to one another. Few things are clearer than that corporate media are not the appropriate hosts for that conversation. Now there's an opportunity to shore up local and community news media as a resource. Craig Aaron, president of the group Free Press, will join us to talk about that. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press. Watching the corporate media these days is interesting. How will an elite press corps, used to gesturing publicly toward independence while laughing behind closed doors at black tie dinners with the powerful officials they're charged with scrutinizing, treat someone who straight up berates and threatens them? Early signs are discouraging. As FAIR associate Norman Solomon wrote for FAIR.org, the weather forecast points toward an evasive fog, judging by the roundtable segment on the PBS NewsHour, November 21st. The news there was that Trump won't be traditional. As NewsHour regular Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report said, quote, "We have to stop treating Donald Trump like this is just a traditional, normal political candidate who's now going to be a traditional, normal president," close quote. Tamara Keith, a White House correspondent for NPR, then explained that Trump, quote, "has not related to the press or the public in a traditional way ever. And he's had an incredible skill at distracting, at creating..." There was this movie Up, and there was a dog who gets distracted and squirrel, squirrel. That's what happens, close quote. So here we have political journalists marveling at Trump's ability to create distractions while they keep themselves and their audience distracted, as Keith demonstrates. Quote, "Every time there is a story that is not favorable to him, like settling the Trump University lawsuit for $25 million, suddenly there is a Twitter fight. Meanwhile, he has skillfully avoided sort of the type of environment that a press conference creates, the environment where you get asked a question and then somebody else asks a question and then somebody else asks a question. It builds on it, and you really can't escape. There's nothing like a press conference." And his transition team is saying, well, you know, don't tell him what's traditional and what's conventional. This is Donald Trump, close quote. So, right before your eyes, Keith veers away from mention of an actual issue, the Trump University fraud settlement, to focus on stagecraft and a sort of mythological idea of how press conferences work. Later on, she would say of Trump's cabinet appointments, quote, "the people that he's picked are the people we should be focusing on," close quote. But then they don't. At one point, someone says the name Jeff Sessions. Judy Woodruff says he has a record. Steve Bannon? Woodruff says he has a private sector record. Well, what were those records? Why do they matter? That didn't come up. The cherry on the sundae came at the end as Woodruff asked Walter, "Do we just get used to this?" The answer, yes, you have to just get used to all of this. As it happens, many people are coming to a very different conclusion. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Fidel Castro, who died November 25th at age 90, will be remembered as someone whose work changed not just Cuba, but the wider world.
with U.S. media ringing with denunciation, with some left over to denunciate those who aren't denunciating enough, there's little oxygen left for discussion of that work and what it meant and still means. We're joined now for some context on Castro and Cuba by Luis Perez. He's professor of history at the University of North Carolina and editor of Cuban Journal and author of, among other titles, Cuba: Between Reform and Revolution. He joins us now by phone from North Carolina. Welcome to Counterspin, Luis Perez.
Good day. How are you?
Well, to hear the TV talkers tell it, Fidel Castro was not just an evil monster, he was a sort of Svengali who somehow tricked millions of people into supporting his project. There's a sense that the only reason not to despise him is delusion, you know. And that seems to disavow any agency on the part of the Cuban people, among other things. They're seen as engaging in some sort of idol worship. I have heard you say that Fidel resonates because the Cuban Revolution resonates. Can you give us some context for why that's the case?
The most extraordinary facet of the coverage of the last 5-6 days in this country has been the utter lack of self-reflection and ignorance of context. And I think you've used the word context already twice in your introductory comments. It is so easy, it is so facile to focus on one man. Americans love the great man thesis, one man to whom one can attribute everything that torments one. It is so easy to identify this, the outcomes in Cuba, the outcomes in Central America, the outcomes in Africa, to one guy. That liberates anybody from exploring context, from exploring process, from exploring history, from understanding how this phenomenon that Fidel Castro represents unfolds. And so what we have here is just an utterly one-dimensional assessment of the past and the present. And Fidel Castro is that evil person to whom one can attribute everything that one doesn't like about the world.
When Cubans talk about it, of course, there's a completely different approach to it and a completely different kind of reckoning with it. But as you say, U.S. readers have gotten, first of all, very little information, period. But then also the information has been kind of cartoonish. So what can you tell, and also for younger folks who don't know, what was the Cuban Revolution? What did it signify? What did it change?
The Cuban Revolution comes out of a history. It comes out of a struggle by a people that has its antecedents in the middle of the 19th century, and it represents successive generations of Cubans who aspire, however unlikely it would appear, coming from a little country, a small population. The Cuban historical purpose for 150 years has been given to the pursuit of self-determination and national sovereignty. If the Cuban Revolution is about anything, it's about self-determination and national sovereignty. And so that's an idea that goes back to the 1850s, and it's articulated by José Martí in the 1880s and 1890s, and it continues to kind of circulate, and it becomes a politics in Cuba with the inauguration of the Republic in 1902. So Fidel Castro comes out of that history. He is formed by that sensibility. And so what the Cuban Revolution represents on January 1959, and certainly this is the point that Fidel Castro makes, it is the culmination of a process. It is, finally, a people who have achieved self-determination and national sovereignty, and the obstacle in the 19th century was Spain, and the obstacle in the 20th century was the United States. So the revolution comes with this purpose of affirming Cuba for Cubans, and finally, the prospects of agency, of seizing hold of those forces that govern one's life. And that means inevitably to reduce the presence and the influence of the United States in Cuba. And that's the one condition that since the 19th century, the United States was not willing to acquiesce to Cuba, from Jefferson until George W. Bush and perhaps even Obama. The idea of Cuban national sovereignty and self-determination has been, and it continues to be, an anathema.
as in other places as well. But I think it's such an important understanding of the relationship. Reuters, in their write-up, said that Castro, quote, built a communist state on the doorstep of the United States, close quote, which I find funny, as though the proximity of this tiny island were an affront or a provocation to the United States. You know, it reminds me of the comic activist Professor Irwin Corey, who was a big supporter of the revolution. He told my colleague Steve Rendell that he had complained to Castro that for 40 years you've refused to remove your country from around our military base. You know, it is, of course, the relationship with the world superpower. It is that sovereignty that drew the admiration of people, of oppressed people the world over, that defiance, and how strange to present it still today as a threat to the United States.
Well, I think the word you use is correct, the affront. Fidel Castro was a breathing, living reminder of the limit of American power. How is it possible that the United States could not do something about this guy? And successive generations of American political leaders and 11 presidential administrations more or less all take power saying they're going to do something about Fidel Castro. The presidential terms come and go, and he's still there, and he survives the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the Cuban Revolution continues, admittedly limping, but still continues to survive. So I think it's that defiance that just galled Americans, their inability to will the world according to their wishes in a place that had always willed the world. There's something profoundly psychological. Mm-hmm. Fidel Castro becomes a highly personal issue to Americans. And the multiple attempts to assassinate it can't make it any more personal than that.
Well, what you're talking about, the importance of sovereignty, and that, as I understand it, it became an overweening focus on sovereignty, and then the security state that is understandably lamented. Now, you see that as a kind of cautionary tale.
That's exactly how I see it. I see the Cuban development. Does the system resort to repressive techniques? Absolutely. Has it spawned an elaborate surveillance and intelligence system? Absolutely. It has done all these things. I think it's important to bear in mind that this has a context. This was a state, a government, administration, rulers, who were confronted with the most powerful country in the world that had as a single overriding determination regime change. And when the Cubans invoke national security, then all bets are off, as we are learning in this country. When one invokes national security, then civil liberties, constitutional freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of association, freedom of thought, that space begins to contract, get smaller and smaller. And, you know, again, when I said earlier the lack of self-reflection, I think anybody has to go to the Alien and Sedition Laws at the end of the 18th century after the American Revolution. When the Americans felt threatened by the French, and they passed the sedition laws, and anybody who published or said anything against the United States government would be subject to imprisonment. And how about the Japanese Americans, who the United States, feeling threatened by Japan, rounds up tens of thousands of Japanese Americans and puts them in camps? So it's that lack of context, it's that lack of appreciation of it's like people say, well, the economy is in shambles in Cuba. It is. But to what degree is the shambles of the Cuban economy the outcome of a punitive embargo that had at its direct purpose to make the Cuban economy one of shambles? So it is this loop of opinion that feeds on itself, and we just can't seem to break or get out of it.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, we had started to see, you know, it was being called a thaw. We saw some diplomatic relations being established earlier this year with Cuba. Now, you know, things are different. What do you imagine happening now in terms of the relationship between U.S., the United States, and Cuba, and what do you think would serve Cubans?
If the new incoming administration presumes to act on the utterances of this past weekend, then I think anybody, any persons of goodwill, any persons who derive comfort at the process of normalization of the last 2 years, cannot but despair and feel very anxious. The words of the president-elect saying that he wants to withdraw the concessions, quote-unquote, unless the Cubans, among other things, open up their economy for market reform, free political prisoners, hold elections, allow parties, political parties. We are now going to be plunged back to the worst days of, I don't even know what the comparison would be, the Reagan years, the George W. Bush years, because these are the demands that the Cubans have resisted for 55 years, because this is, again, a throwback to the curtailment and the challenge to the Cuban insistence upon self-determination and national sovereignty. So if these folks who are coming in January proceed to act on those politics, then we're in for some very, very difficult times, U.S.-Cuba relations.
We've been speaking with Luis Perez, professor of history at the University of North Carolina and author of, among other books, Cuba Between Reform and Revolution. Luis Perez, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
You're very welcome.
As big corporate media try to puzzle out whether they can get away with their usual lapdog routine with a president-elect who openly berates and threatens them, many people have already determined that big corporate media are not actually where they're going to be looking for the news and perspectives that we need to help us forward in these times and inform our resistance to a racist, sexist, anti-worker, anti-poor, anti-environment, anti-civil liberties administration. Just as many now look to states and local governments for legislative and policy protections, some see the local space as a site of hopefulness for news media as well. It's not just pipe dreams. There is a development on that front. And here to tell us about it is Craig Aaron, president of the group Free Press. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Craig Aaron.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Well, let's get right to it. I just read an article headlined, "A Chance to Invest Millions in the News and Information People Need." So what's the story?
Well, we have this really unique opportunity that I think could be one of the answers to how do we actually provide the journalism and meet the community information needs that have gone, you know, underserved or unserved for so long. And it basically works like this. The Federal Communications Commission is in the midst of auctioning off a big chunk of the public airwaves. And they're asking broadcasters, or they're not really asking, they're paying them, to go off the air or move their stations to another channel in order to create more space for mobile data. So they're going to move the TV stations out and turn around and auction off those airwaves to mobile phone companies and others. In the middle of all this are a number of public television stations, of at least 54 considering it by our count at Free Press. And we think these are public stations using the public airwaves with public interest obligations, and yet the public hasn't been brought into this conversation about what happens when these stations are auctioned off and what happens to all the money. And we're talking potentially about a lot of money, billions and billions of dollars that will go to the licensed owners of these stations. So when we're talking about public stations, these are state and local governments, universities, other nonprofit institutions. And we're particularly interested in the state of New Jersey, which owns four public TV stations valued by the FCC for as much as $2.3 billion. So even if only some of the stations are sold and the price comes down in the auction, which it will do, we could still be talking about hundreds of millions of dollars created going into the coffers of New Jersey. And we're stepping in to say we need to use some of that money to set up a permanent public fund that will actually support independent local journalism projects, public media, other innovative community information projects. And this is actually a chance to do it, a windfall, hundreds of millions of dollars that could be used to create the journalism that communities actually need.
So just to be clear, it's not that we would be calling for this to happen. It's happening. The question is, you know, the stations are selling off these airwaves. The question is what happens with the money and will the public have some say in that?
Exactly. So the auction is going to happen either way, and they're going to clear out these channels, something like channel 33 to 51 on the dial. There's not going to be TV stations there anymore. And so the question becomes, yeah, what happens to all of that money? You know, if Congress was doing their job, they would already set aside some of these funds to support community information needs. But the fact is, you know, we think that we'd like to see all stations contribute, but we think these public stations, as public television stations, have an added obligation, and that the money from their sale shouldn't simply go to shore up some short-term state budget holes or fill out a university endowment, that we actually need to reinvest it in local communities. And the only way that that's going to happen is if we campaign and push for it. So that's what we're starting to do in New Jersey. Depending on the final results of the auction, we don't know what those are yet. There may be other cities, that the Washington, D.C., Chicago, that might benefit if indeed their stations are sold and are going off the air. It's a little bit of a black box while it's happening. The people in the auction can't actually talk about the auction, but we know that it's happening. We know that there are dozens of public television stations involved, and we know there are hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, at stake. And that question is, how should we spend that money? That's the part of the conversation we're looking to change.
Well, activists that I've been talking to have been saying they're not wanting to give up on the federal level, but they are saying we might look to local levels and the state levels for some interventions that could actually help real people in real time. You know, that the country is not just the president and the people, although media sometimes sort of present it that way, and not just in their content, but also in their structure. You know, we've seen a number of local outlets disappear. So a place like you're talking about, like New Jersey, they might get news from Philadelphia, they might get news from New York, but the big media conglomerates say, we don't really need to serve this specific community. You know, they'll be happy enough with news from the nearest big city. So there's a real void here that could be filled.
That's right, and I think this is one of those answers. The fact is that the corporate media, the market, has not been providing news in these places in huge parts of our country where, you know, tens of thousands of journalists lost their job. We're quickly approaching, you know, we're going to have half the number of daily journalists working than we had a couple of decades ago. There's so much going uncovered at the local level, you know, in the places where people really can make a difference. But those school board meetings and those activities of local officials are simply not being covered, even all the way up to our members of Congress and senators who used to have, you know, five or six reporters following them around. Maybe there's one now. So much is going uncovered, and we see the impact at the local level. You know, more corruption, less money's brought home to districts, less accountability, all the way up to, you know, the election of Donald Trump. A lot of this can be laid right at the feet of this media failure and the fact that journalism institutions are really weak at a moment where we need them to be stronger. So we have to start looking for other answers. We just can't hope it will work out. We've got to find other sources to get the kind of news and information we need to actually have a functioning democracy. You know, there's really that much at stake. So I think we do have to look at the state level. There's a lot of defense to be played at the federal level to try to protect the victories we've had, to try to protect the most vulnerable who are going to be the first in line when all of these terrible changes happen. But at the same time, we got to look for opportunities like this that, you know, offer a different vision, offer some long-term change, and really kind of build, for lack of a better word, sanctuaries at the city and state level against what's happening in these national trends.
Well, we know that the void that we're talking about is there for a reason. It's not that people said they didn't care about local news. You know, it's not that people said, as we often hear, oh, well, we have the internet, we don't need that anymore. You know, people have always been interested in news at their community level, but the policy changes have been enabled by the FCC, which has been sort of slowly, steadily eroding the public interest obligations, you know, that would protect those things. And on that front, we now may have an administration that wants to straight out eliminate the FCC, which would seem to make these kinds of efforts even more important.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, that is something we're worried about, you know, not necessarily that the FCC, the building, will disappear, but that you basically won't be able to tell the difference of whether there's an FCC or not. And the kind of folks that the Trump administration is putting on the transition team, the likely candidates to take over there, have a really dangerous and damaging agenda. And you can see already every big corporate player lining up with their wish list of the things that they haven't been able to get done for the last 10 years. You know, they're going to try to gut media ownership limits. They're coming for net neutrality. They're going to try to prevent poor people from getting broadband, even, you know, doing away with fixes to, you know, overcharging on prison phones. I mean, all the way down the list, they're going to come for those policies. We're going to have to fight that. But we're also going to have to build alternatives. And one thing about political moments like this is that they're moments of clarity. And the question, you know, the question that FAIR's been asking forever about the failures of the corporate media, well, those aren't questions anymore.
Right.
If they were, you know,
right.
the evidence is in, and we've got to start talking about how are we going to build an alternative. We think using these public resources in smart ways that actually serve local communities, that are actually innovative, that actually go out and ask people what kind of news and information they want, is a big part of that. Because if they start seeing the stories they actually care about, their communities reflected in a real way, a lot more people are going to care about the future of journalism and the future of news when it's actually benefiting their lives and not doing what it's done for far too long, which is frankly misrepresenting and harming them.
We've been speaking with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of Free Press. They're online at freepress.net, and that's where you can also get involved in their actions around this spectrum auction. Craig Aaron, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website. It's FAIR.org, and that's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.